Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. Our guest today is Annalisa Perea, who is a Fresno City Council member representing District 1, which is where we both live. So yay, we get to have our own council member on the podcast.
All right.
And Annalisa has represented District 1 on the Fresno City Council since 2022. She is also an urban planner, and we're really excited to have a very nerdy planning conversation with you today. And I also just want to preface for our listeners on the podcast that this is a conversation with Annalisa that is more about understanding your governing philosophy as a planner, as a person who's lived in Fresno for most of your life, and not necessarily a conversation where we're going to like rapid fire for all of your positions on things. This just to clear the air with some people, like this is not the time and place for that. I know you're talking to one of my reporters about really specifics on one issue, and that's the role that they play, and we want to get into the weedy philosophy, so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is fun for me because I have two of the most influential urban planners in the city of Fresno sitting at the table with me.
Annalisa is the influential one.
I think operating one of our most important journalistic outlets in town and on city council, I would say you two with your urban planning background have more influence than most urban planners in the city. Let's start with big picture. There's two core concepts in urban planning. There's many, but the ones I want to tease out are interconnectedness and complexity. And these are two factors that are constantly at work in decisions you make. I would argue that interconnectedness is about how pieces fit together, and complexity is what pieces are on the board, if you will. And so I want to hear both your perspectives because I want to hear compare and contrasting views on this. As planners, which poses the bigger challenge to a city like Fresno? The interconnectedness of the pieces or understanding what pieces are at work? Do you want to go first, Annalisa?
Man, when I think of interconnectivity, I think of regional planning. And I would love to just think about the city of Fresno because I'm here to represent the city, but thinking a little bit bigger picture, we have to think regionally at the same time. There's other cities, there's 14 other cities in this county, and if we are not talking to those other 14 cities, then we're not doing our job as policymakers and as regional planners to do what I think is in the best interest for the people in our city. We all have family in Sanger, Selma, Fowler, Parlier, and other cities around the county. And right now we're having conversations about how do we connect everybody. Right now we're losing funding for healthcare in our rural communities. And so connectivity now more than ever is a big issue. It's a hot button topic, and it's one that is at the forefront of people's minds. But beyond interconnectivity, and if we're thinking more micro city level, it's the components within our city that we are still trying to grasp. And what I mean by that is we have issues like zoning conflicts, right? We hear a lot about this, especially in the southern parts of our city. We have a lot of zoning conflicts between sensitive receptors and, we'll say, industrial. And for some, it does get complex as to should we site certain zoning designations next to each other? If not, what does that separation need to be? And everyone has a different definition of how we should separate uses and by how many feet. That's a big issue right now at the city of Fresno, and it's one that we have not done a good job historically defining and prioritizing. And that's why right now we do have a lot of conflicting land uses that are butting up against each other.
Donnie, how would you answer that question when you think about interconnectedness and complexity, which is the biggest issue that Fresno faces?
Yeah, I think Annalisa is totally right in the sense of it's hard to understand Fresno without thinking about the larger context in which we sit, both in terms of Fresno being the the unofficial capital, both of Fresno County and also of the Central Valley, being the economic center of the region. I grew up on a farm, and Fresno was the big city, and that was always a fun thing. But so I totally understand what you mean in terms of decision makers in Fresno have to always be acknowledging how both the decisions that you make affect other places, affect the county, affect Clovis, and vice versa. What Clovis does, what Madera does, what Selma does in some ways does affect us. I think that interconnectedness is something that is more intuitive for planners, and it is on us in some ways to think about the regional systems that level the playing field across all of the different places. And so who sets the playing table for tax sharing? Who sets the playing table for where, when does Target go to Fresno versus Target going to Clovis? When does a university get go to Clovis versus Fresno, et cetera? And we've never done a great job in the Central Valley of setting good regional tables to really make those decisions in an equitable way. And I think that's why we have such a food fight, for lack of a better term, all the time over resources and taxes and economic benefits.
Why do you think there hasn't been equity in setting those kind of tables, Annalisa?
Man, like Danielle said, we are the capital of the county, so to say, the city of Fresno, and usually the larger player tends to get a larger piece of the pie. I think we're going to see this spelled out with the renewal of Measure C coming up, and I know the other 14 cities are going to be looking for a bigger cut of the pie, and how they come out and advocate and what the allocation ends up being at the end of the day, I think will be the present day table setting measure of how we allocate resources, not just amongst ourselves, but with the other neighboring cities as well.
Okay, let's talk about the private sector now. Do you think our current planning processes over or underestimate the capacity of markets to solve problems like housing and transportation? How would you answer that question?
That's a great question. And I'll tell you that as a planner in the private sector for the last 15 years, I've had the opportunity to work across cities all over the Central Valley. And there are some cities that have a great entitlement process, and there's others that I think could use a little bit of help. I'll tell you that we are in a housing crisis, and Fresno is not unique to other cities in the state. But we don't always act like it. And so when we had the wildfires down in LA, the governor was talking about exempting new housing construction from CEQA, right? He wanted to talk about rebuilding quicker. And I think we should have more of those conversations about how do we build housing quicker. We have very little capacity in available housing stock right now for home purchases and for home rentals. And so when we talk about building our way out of a housing crisis, I don't know if we're ever going to do that, but one way that we are tackling it here in Fresno is through the ministerial process. And that is an item that is going to be coming before us soon. And what that essentially means is we are going to be expediting not just any housing, but multifamily housing infill, because we talk a lot about not wanting to sprawl in our city. And so this policy is going to make it easier to build infill denser, so more vertical housing along our transit corridors. I think we need to think differently about how we build in our city. I think we need to make our communities more walkable. I live in a very walkable neighborhood where I can step out my front door and get ice cream or have dinner or go grab a beer. And I want everyone to have that same opportunity. And so this is something I'm really excited about. I've been pushing for it for quite some time, and it's going to be coming back before us very soon.
I have responses, but I want to hear your answer to that question first, Donnie. How do you think the market has, we over or underestimate the capacity for it to address a problem like housing?
I think that it's both, and not that's a cop-out. I think that...
Oh, it's a great academic answer. It depends.
Political answer.
I'm really not trying to be political about this, but I will. Okay, a couple of things. Let's just take housing, for example. Yeah. Housing is a very segmented market. There are developers that only build market rate apartments that are charging upwards of $2,000 a month for rent for a one bedroom apartment. There are developers that specialize in only building single family homes and generally higher end homes. And this is like Wilson Homes and those types of more specialty developers. There are developers that will only build single family homes that are more in like the entry level, $300,000 to $400,000 single family homes. There are developers that only build affordable housing. And I feel like what's happened is we have a market, we have more actors in the single family home space that know how to do that well, because for a long time that has been the predominant product that we've built in Fresno. And so their response to City Hall, and this is my outside perspective, so you feel free to push back, their response is, this is what we know how to build, so give us the land so we can build what we've always done.
They can do it efficiently, it makes more money.
Exactly. Et cetera. They know how to get it done, release all the red tape so we can just keep doing this thing we've always done. And when you look at the data and what people, where the demand is much more complicated, we don't need more $600,000 single family homes in Fresno. We need affordable, both market, affordable market rate, not necessarily deeply subsidized, but we need more affordable home ownership and we need more affordable rental. And there's not a ton of actors that are in that space that are building those types of products.
Okay. How would you respond to what she's describing?
I would agree. And this is exactly why we're trying to get creative with how do we bring more of that multifamily developer type development to the city. And so I think what this policy is going to do is it's going to offer an expedited mechanism, hopefully, to attract multifamily developers to come to Fresno so that we can build more dense, more vertical, more mixed use, and put these developments along transit corridors so we can promote the usage of alternative modes of transportation as well.
So what you're saying, the central problem why we don't have those is the bottlenecks from red tape. Is that what you're saying, the reason why they're not building more multifamily units in the city of Fresno? You know,
I think developers definitely follow the market and the demand. And so if the demand here in Fresno is that everyone wants to live in a single family home, I think there's a reason why those developers are here. But I want to do more to attract, hopefully, more of an alternative type of developer, the one that likes to build the denser developments. And if removing the red tape is what they look for when they decide upon which city to go to, then I'm all for removing the red tape.
Hopefully that's the lever. Let's talk about...
I just think it's going to be a little bit more complicated.
Yeah, go on. What other factors should we consider?
I think CEQA, removing zoning barriers is huge, and developers will say this over and over again, but I think that we all probably know about the YIMBY movement, Yes in My Backyard, and they've done a ton of statewide policy work to try to remove a lot of the state's barriers to building more housing, more denser housing in urban areas, especially in the Bay Area and LA. And they passed all these reforms, and those reforms haven't necessarily trickled down to Fresno to result in more housing. So I'm really excited that we have more reform on the table because that is really needed. But what they're learning statewide is that we still have obstacles in the building code that are making it really hard for developers to build denser housing. We still have really high interest rates. And when I talk to apartment developers, they're like, I still can't get financing if interest rates are at 6%. Like, what am I supposed to do with that? We still have really expensive supply chains. And so there's a lot of other parts of the puzzle. I mean, not to diminish the ministerial, but just to say, I want to temper people's expectations because there's a lot of things happening.
Yeah, Annalisa was describing what is in her locus of control, which is reducing red tape, and then you also have to deal with the market. But let's talk about SEDA for a second, because this is the elephant in the room in this discussion. I guess my question is, how does that fit into what you're describing? Because that's expanding our city limits, it is increasing infrastructure costs. Like, how do you think about this in this kind of vision that you're describing of more diverse housing options?
Yeah, there's no argument that our city is growing. And so whether we can't go to the north because of the river, we can't go to the east because of Clovis, what I made a promise to my residents is that I would not approve any other growth area until the West Area Neighborhood Specific Plan was adopted. And so we have fulfilled that promise. I believe SEDA was supposed to come to us before that, but I made it very clear that I would not even consider that until this other plan was adopted. And so now that has come and gone. The next question is, okay, what's in the pipeline? What about SEDA? What about the South Central Specific Plan? What about the other growth areas in our city? Present day, SEDA still has some big question marks for me that I want answered. I don't want to expand our city limits just for the sake of expanding our city limits at this point. It has to make sense financially. And I'm still not quite at a place where it makes sense to me in my head. And so I'm still taking a lot of meetings, not just from residents out in the community, but there's still a lot of meetings with staff that I have to sit down and have answered. Because if we approve a growth area, then we need to fully understand what the cost is going to be for our existing residents. If we expand our city limits, are we going to be able to provide the same response times for public safety for the inner city residents, for us? And so on one hand, I am not afraid to grow our city, but it needs to make sense. We need more smart growth policies in place. Historically, we have not had those in our city, and it shows. Historically, we have not had city planners on the city council making decisions, and I think it shows. And so while on one hand, again, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but I'm not afraid to grow our city, but it needs to make sense, and it cannot come at the expense of our existing residents.
It's hard to estimate what the cost will be. So how do you make the decision in light of some of those, that the nature of it being opaque?
I'm a big fan of contiguous development, right? So if we're going to have policies set in place that require us to grow contiguously up against city limits, maybe that makes sense. What we don't want to see is all this leapfrog development, whether it's out in Seda or even out on, in the West area. What we don't want is more leapfrog development. And so when it comes down to the cost is not just fiscally, what's the public safety return on investment? Right now, we are doing great when it comes to response times. I had to call the fire department the other night, and they were here within 30 seconds, it felt like. Is that response time going to increase if now we're having to spread our resources further? So the cost, again, is not just a fiscal cost. It could be a matter of life or death to some degree. I don't want to sound dramatic. There's a lot that we have to consider when you think of cost.
How would you think about what she's describing in terms of how to think about SEDA?
I think those are the right questions. What is this going to cost in terms of emergency response times? And how does it affect the picture of how people who have already been living in our city and older neighborhoods experience their city? But there are ways to, we have cost estimates for SEDA. This is not unknowable. And I think
it's hard to know, maybe not unknowable.
But you're never going to get the most precise thing possible because it's always going to be a moving target.
Right.
But planners live in a world where you just have to have data in order to make decisions.
Sure.
You need to know a couple of things. You need to know how much should we plan to build for? And so we're having this like side conversation around SEDA around what's the city's population growth rate trajectory and how do we not overbuild? And then you're stuck in a situation where, you know, what happened on the west side and why some of the west area neighborhoods were struggling was that a lot more housing was approved during the housing boom of the 2000s than we had a market crash. And a bunch of subdivisions were built that did not get filled out. The fees that were supposed to accumulate from developers to pay into public safety to build fire stations were never paid because the market crashed. And the city had, I think there was a fire station operating out of a tract home for a decade on the west side.
We still have one operating out of a home, that's Station 12.
Yeah.
But happy to say that we are building a brand new station for them over on Ashland and Valentine.
Yes, so. That's right. That's the one I was thinking of. And that's in part because if you overbuild and then the fees don't come through, you are not left with the just basics of public safety to serve communities.
Absolutely.
A very arrested development situation over there.
I want to talk about, Donnie brought up YIMBYs. I want to talk about NIMBYs for a second. We have situations where communities fight back to keep certain types of housing out of their neighborhoods. What's the city's role in that? How do you think about how to both communicate with these people and how to make decisions in light of local, chances are, small contingents within a neighborhood pushing back against housing?
Yeah, so getting public input is how we help shape our decisions. And so I'm thinking of the multifamily housing project that was proposed over in Northwest Fresno, and it was allowed by, and the residents came out and they said, not in my backyard. And everyone had a different reason. I have to respect that. That's democracy in action. They came out, they fought for something that they did not want in their neighborhood for whatever reason.
What do you mean respect that? Like when you say respect that, like what are you saying exactly? Like we need to let that guide your decision making, or respect that they need the opportunity to share their voice?
I'm a big fan of public input. And so while I am one person on the city council, I represent over 85,000 people in my district. And so no matter what decision I make, I'm going to upset someone, right? But what helps shape my decisions are when my 85,000 bosses come out and they say, hey, this is what I like, or this is what I don't like. This is what I don't want in my backyard, or I do want this, vote for this, please. In that specific case that I just mentioned, those Northwest Fresno residents. They exercised their right to provide public input, and they had their voice heard, and their council member went with what they wanted. He voted against that housing project.
But that's not, that's a small constituency within a large community.
The Northwest Fresno.
Yeah, the people voice. That show up and yeah. attend those meetings. We've had so much journalism, not at Fresnoland specifically, but about small groups of people that have time to attend these meetings and disrupting things that might be good for a city. And it's frustrating.
It correct me if I'm wrong, it feels like that is not the main problem that we face in Fresno at the moment, is residents killing housing projects.
Yeah.
Unless I've seen, how much has this been an issue that you've seen?
Residents coming out to kill housing. It's not a big one, but it's a personal one. Mm-hmm. And so when residents feel like whether it's a drug rehabilitation yeah. project or a housing project, whatever the use is, whatever excites people and makes the hair on the back of their neck stand up, they come out and they either speak out at a council meeting, they write emails, they send text messages. Most everyone has my personal cell phone, and so that's always going off. And I appreciate this is democracy in action.
Donna, do you have thoughts about that question?
No.
You don't?
About what's the question?
I'm just trying to get you both in trouble.
Tension at play in the YIMBY debate, and you see this play out in a lot of statewide policy debates where there is this who, you know, on the one hand, I think a lot of people, certainly younger people, have coalesced around YIMBY because a lot of young people feel locked out of the housing market. They feel like they can't access it. They see a lot of wealthy homeowners stopping a lot of new projects. And so it's like a clear just cut off resident opinion because it's clearly blocking my access to a more accessible housing market. Understand that perspective. But then there's another group of people that are saying, okay, but for historical reason, there's a lot of history around public input that has not been allowed to shape planning processes. And when it comes to redlining and historic disinvestment of communities or communities being bulldozed to create new freeways. And so
sure.
people who come from that perspective are saying, whoa, we can't just cut off resident feedback because when we've done that in the past, we've basically blocked and bulldozed over communities of color, predominantly in California and across the US. But I think then there's this question of whose opinion matters in the public process. And that's a really tricky question. I don't know how you think about that, but that's one that I feel like I see, it's a tension I see frequently.
Yeah, how do you think about that question?
It goes back to, I have over 80,000 bosses in my district alone, citywide, you know, over half of a million. I try to reach as many people as possible. And my promise was, I will always bring City Hall to your neighborhood. And so I hold consistent neighborhood meetings. I hold district town halls every year throughout the year. And I'm just always trying to make sure that I'm engaged and I'm listening to folks and that I have a good pulse on what is important to people these days. And so I've always supported housing projects. While I understand that the residents from Northwest Fresno didn't want it for different reasons, I think if a multifamily project is good enough for south of Schatz, it sure as heck is going to be good enough north of Shaw, too.
Let's conclude with downtown. In most cities that have thriving downtowns, there's some kind of external constraint on growth, whether that's a physical barrier, urban growth barrier, greenbelt, like they have in Atlanta. Why do you think that's never been a serious part of discussion in Fresno before?
Why we don't have a greenbelt?
Or just any sort of growth constraint that would help downtown and older neighborhoods thrive more consistently.
You know, what a lot of people don't see is the world that happens below our feet. There's a whole city planning happening below the ground we walk on. It's sewer lines, it's water lines, it's broadband lines. It's the unsexy part of government, right? But it's everything you don't see. And for so long, the life below our feet was not in a position that would allow for increased growth downtown. And thanks to the governor and the hard work of our state legislature, we're receiving hundreds of millions of dollars right now to invest back into the infrastructure below our ground. And so if you're driving through downtown, you're going to see roads dug up. And that's because we are doing work right now below our feet to increase the growth capacity. And so once those lines are completed, then that will allow us to basically have a blank slate to now build vertically above the ground here in downtown. And we need the infrastructure, right, to support tens of thousands of new housing down here in the downtown area. you don't want to flush your toilet and know that something bad is going to happen. We need the sewer capacity to accommodate for more housing. And so we definitely need more rooftops in our downtown. I've lived downtown before. I used to live in the Iron Bird Lofts. And so I know what it's like to, again, walk out your front door and below your feet is a coffee shop. But I think that has been the biggest detriment to the burst of our downtown is just not having the proper infrastructure to support the growth in the first place.
We conclude these podcasts each week with what we're loving this week. I'm going to start this time. What I'm loving this week is on Wednesday, we had a special screening for the new Ken Burns documentary that's coming out next month. I hosted a wonderful panel where we discussed the American Revolution, how it connects to polarization that we're experiencing in the United States right now. And we got to watch about a one-hour segment, and it looks incredible. Some people are saying it's Ken Burns' best documentary he's made, and it comes out November 16th, and I am very excited to watch it. I'm a history nerd, so it's what I'm loving this week. Annalisa, what are you loving this week?
My wife is a big Dodgers fan.
Oh, God. So, how is she doing? How's her pulse? I am, too, and I disclosed this recently. Is she on a ledge or on a cliff somewhere? Because at 5 o'clock is coming fast.
We've had to turn off the games a couple times.
Yeah. Just walk away. Don't look at it.
While I'm happy for her that they made it that far to begin with, I'm not a Dodgers fan.
No.
And so this week has been bittersweet for me. I'm happy for her and her team. They've made it to the World Series.
You have a split household?
We have a very split household.
Are you a Giants fan?
I am a Giants fan.
Okay.
Good job.
Out of fairness, though, because she did carry the children, I did vow that my children could be Dodger fans. So
I think they make their own choice, right? And they'll choose the right thing. I believe them. I believe in them. They'll choose the right thing.
There will be a time and place for them, yeah, and that decision.
Yeah, just put two colored placards, blue and orange, in front of them and just have them reach out to one.
You know what's going to happen is they're going to do what my kids did, and they're going to just choose their own team based on totally random things.
I think that's a good way to do it. Just make your kids Switzerland so they're not getting in the middle of their parents.
Yeah,
that's what I did, and that's why I'm a Miami Dolphins football fan.
Yeah.
Wait, whoa.
That is...
Okay. Is this because of Ace Ventura?
No, it's because... In the second grade, my mom coached my softball team, and we were called the Dolphins.
Nice.
So ever since then, NFL team, the Dolphins.
Great.
Perfect.
Love it.
Yeah. And if your kids need a team, the Sacramento A's, they need more fans, that's for sure.
That's very true.
Donnie, what are you loving this week?
Okay. So I have to just shout out the best hip-hop teacher in town. Her name is Deborah McCoy, and she runs an outlet called McCoy Hip Hop, and she teaches hip-hop classes at both of my kids' schools, and I've gone to their hip-hop performances, both of them, in the last week. And
I have seen some of Joaquin's dance moves. He is cutting a rug.
I get so much joy watching my kids, and of course, I'm a parent, so obviously I'm going to get joy watching my kids do hip-hop, but the way that Miss McCoy teaches these kids and how she lights up and brings them out, it's incredible. She's a force of nature. That woman.
Have you learned any dance moves yourself?
Absolutely not. My kids try to teach me. And they do little dance-offs in our living room together. And it's adorable.
That is so cute. This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.